You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN, LPFM Radio 106.9, Salida, Colorado, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. My co-host this evening is Vicki Davis, and we have had her on the program a number of other times, and she's a researcher and systems analyst. And our special guest today is our mayor of Salida, Chuck Rose. And I would like, Chuck, say hi. And if you would like to, Vicki, let me go ahead and let you start it out and see where get the conversation rolling.
Okay. As I was saying before we actually started the program, but what we're interested in, I've been studying the reinvention of government that began during the Clinton administration, and it's basically a reorganization of our federal government, and now it's rolling down into our states and into our cities. And so what we're interested in talking to the mayor about is how involved he was with the reinvention of government, and perhaps, you know, what organizations he might belong to, like the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and how much of the agenda of redesign they pass on down through their organization to our local communities. Is that a good explanation?
That's a good start, isn't it? Well, my name's Chuck Rose. I'm the mayor of Salida. I'm 3.5 years. I've been mayor for 3.5 years, which means I'm about 18 months into my second term. It is a 2-year term here. It's a weak mayor government. We are a statutory city, so I act within the bounds of state statutes. For those who are listening outside of Colorado, statutory means that the base laws that our city is governed under are written by the state assembly. Now, these may have been written in the 1800s, but those are the ones that govern us, plus any changes they make. There's also what they call home rule cities, and that occurs with a vote of the people, and it creates much greater latitude in terms of the form of government you use and how you might structure your city council and what your mayor might do. So we are a statutory city. The little zone we are in Chaffee County in the Arkansas River Valley, starting in Leadville, going to Buena Vista, Poncha Springs, and Salida, they're all statutory cities. I jokingly say we have a zone of people who don't trust government, and so they want the state assembly to create our rules rather than let us create our rules for ourselves. So that's where we're at here.
And
I don't know, Vicki and Melody, if you'd like to prompt me with some questions, or if you want me to just continue. I think it would be more, as I asked the question, it might be a little bit more directive if you guys ask questions to me.
And we're totally okay with that, because that's exactly what we'd like to do. Now, one thing that you, when you got into the statutory part, you might go ahead and explain a little bit about home rule then, because that was something that was brought up in the process of you being in office, right? Or was this beforehand?
Well, it's gone on for some time. And one of the issues with home rule is you vote and become a home rule city. The very first thing you do is you create a committee to write the charter. You vote and decide your governmental entity is going to become a home rule entity, whether it's a county or a city. And then you adopt, in another vote, the charter. The charter would be the equivalent of the Constitution, you know, that would govern your actions as elected officials and citizens of that particular area. And as I say, there's greater latitude offered. However, the charter is what determines what you actually do as a home rule city. So it could actually be, the charter could end up being more restrictive. It could be end up being identical, or it could end up being less restrictive in terms of certain issues. Now, what confuses people is it does not mean that, whether it's a city or a county, that they can do things that are not allowed in the state constitution. So there's still restrictions because we are a city within the state of Colorado, and we can't do things against the Constitution. There are certain things, mostly land use, a little bit of tax stuff. For example, 3 years ago, the citizens passed an occupational lodging tax. It's $2.50 per occupied room. And the reason it was that raw number, $2.50, is as a statutory city, we are not allowed to do percentages. Now, we were well aware that this might be onerous on a hostel where they're charging $10 a bed versus it would be to the advantage of a place that has nice suites charging $150. The same person who can afford the $150 is getting taxed $250 per night per room. As a guy sleeping in a bed in a hostel, that's $250. It's actually per room, and we won't go into the specifics of that. But my point is we did not have the option as a statutory city to go with a percentage of room cost, and that's one of the limitations. And there's innumerable others, although those limitations, as I said, the charter could be identical to the one you have currently as a statutory city. That is ultimately the voter's choice. One reason why we haven't chosen to go there is it's an expensive process. We've estimated it would cost the city roughly $25,000 to create and jump through all the hoops and then have the elections. And there's been more pressing issues that we needed to deal with. So statutory city moving to home rule should, in my opinion, be an effort driven by the citizens, not by the elected officials. And I personally believe that should be the case on all issues. It should be citizen-driven. One question that Vicki started the show off with that I did not answer is, what organizations am I a member of? And honestly, there's none that pertain to governing. I do get, you put mayor in front of your name and a dump truck backs up to your door and you get about 1,000 periodicals and 1,000,000 emails from various people. And when you eliminate those periodicals and emails that are trying to sell you something, there's 3 or 4 that offer some really good information. The city is a member of the Colorado Municipal League, which is basically a lobbying and educational institution that a bunch of, I think almost every city and town in the state, are members, and that money funds a group of professionals. And if they feel, for example, there's an issue going before the state assembly that would be detrimental to local government, they will be the lobbying group that will support whatever efforts are ideal for the municipalities. They also create a lot of information that's helpful to us. If, for example, a city administrator leaves, they would offer a list of interim city administrators while you're doing your search. And it's the city that's a member of that. Otherwise, there's wonderful magazines, the chief of which is Governing. That seems to be the best magazine. But I'm not a member of any organizations outside of the stuff I'd be a member of if I wasn't mayor.
What type of seminars have you attended while you've been mayor that are related to the mayor's job?
Well, boy, you know, a lot of them. However, the one that was specifically designed for newly elected officials was the Colorado Municipal League, otherwise we'll hear them called CML. And it was a weekend seminar for newly elected officials, and myself and City Councilman Scott Damon went. As far as I know, we are the only two who've ever attended any of those types of functions. We have staff that attends functions specific to their interests or to the city's needs. We attempted to get a staff member on the Colorado Municipal League's working group that was trying to find solutions in dealing with Union Pacific issues. Because, as you know, UP is the string that all the jewels of these towns were strung from. And in Salida in particular, there's a huge tract of land right next to the city that really helps sort of set the tone for the downtown, whether it's positive or negative is your choice. And dealing with UP can be difficult, and we tried to get our city administrator on that board, and we did not. We were unsuccessful. But he and our finance director and our planning department, they use listservs where there's email conversations and phone conversations if necessary for their specific issues. For example, we are seeing a huge, not huge, but I would say a very significant upturn in sales tax revenue the first quarter of this year. April, I'm guessing, we're going to be over 9% increase of sales tax revenue over last year, which is significant. And so the question becomes, and what the finance directors are discussing, is what's the cause of that? And what they are guessing, there's no scientific basis for this, is the cost of everything are going up, and as a result, the sales tax revenue goes up. But those kinds of things are information that occurs. If I have a question, and I'm doing research, being a mayor, I will call the mayor's office of the cities that have already done what we're trying to do. There's no reason for a town of 5,300 to reinvent the wheel. And if a town or two have already tried a certain project, I will call the mayor up and he'll usually direct me to staff and I can do research that way. And I do that fairly often, actually. But when it comes to other seminars, it's usually because I've been requested. I've been to seminars regarding land use, water use, geothermal. There are seminars, not exactly, the term's not exactly appropriate, that various representatives, Massey and Schwartz, have put together regarding specific topics such as alternative energy, education. I've also been quite active in working with the school board to improve the quality of education in our educational buildings in town. But in terms of organizations where we are hearing philosophical statements or long-term views of how government should evolve, I'm not a member of any of that. I think the question of, firstly, the change of government since Clinton, obviously your guys' research is showing something that I'm unaware of. What I do see is if you look at the founding of our country and where we are now, one of the fallacies, in my opinion, of the constructionists, those who think the Constitution should be very, very narrowly defined based upon what the writers' intentions were, is nothing's the same as it was in the late 1700s. And so government will necessarily evolve. When you increase the size of the country and when you increase the longevity of each citizen to the extent that we have, by those two things alone, things are going to evolve dramatically. There's simply not an option to have a New England town hall form of government for two reasons. We're a very small town of 5,300, but there's not a hall in this town that, assuming you eliminate those who are under voting age, you know, the 3,000 people could get in. That's simply not possible. And the other is, we're usually alone in those meetings. I think whether I haven't been around that long, I'm only 61, but if the lack of citizen involvement in our local government is the same as it's always been, that's absolutely appalling to me.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have noticed, since that you do air these on the public access channel, I do hear comments from people that do watch that, so it isn't like it's being unnoticed. But I do understand what you're saying, because I've been to those meetings, and it isn't just the council meetings, but other meetings that you don't see a lot of public involvement that, you know, that definitely affect everybody.
You know, it's interesting. Now, there's a gentleman who's moved to town within the past few years, who for 10 years was on a city council in a different place, and for four of those years, if I'm correct, and my years might be off, but he also was a mayor. He said as a city councilman, no one ever called him. But as mayor, everybody called him. And when I talk to our city council, I get a lot more calls than anybody else. And that's interesting because it's a weak mayor government. And so technically, the only time I vote is in the setting of a tie. But the city council, well, they vote on every issue. And they are your direct representative, being representative of the ward that they're elected from. It doesn't bother me that people call me. However, what's interesting is it's often after the fact. So, to use a lousy analogy, we have spent over a year working on water rates. for a variety of reasons, and we can go into those specifics if it pertains, if it's helpful to enlighten the conversation today. But when the rates were increased, then people show up. And there's been, it's been mentioned in almost every meeting for over a year. Not only that, we had an engineering report on it and study. It's a lot of money and time has been spent on it. And so even though it's a poor analogy because, you know, what was happening is intellectual, it's as if you're putting the last little top on a pyramid and people say, hey, there's a pyramid in my yard. It's taken a whole year to build a darn thing. And that's because they're citizenry, and it's not Salida, and it's not Chaffee County, and it's not Colorado, it's nationwide. Our citizenry is not engaged, and that is the root of any problem we have in government, in my opinion.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's, I think a lot of that is, first, they don't understand city and state government because it's really not taught in schools. And secondly, everybody has a life to live. And so where all of these people who think that we can have direct participatory democracy, I think they're really quite delusional in thinking that because there's just simply not enough time in the day.
Well, I think that may or may not be true. I think we need to assess what we're spending our time and money on. I also think if that's the choice you make, and some people can't make the choice. Some people just simply are too busy for a variety of reasons that are things that have landed in their life that were unplanned. However, if you have time to, I forgot what it is, I think the average American kid spends 6.5 hours watching television daily. And you know, the parents are usually right in there. And if you're watching television, if you're watching the junk on television, you surely have time to pick up the local paper and spend the 5 minutes it takes to read it. And I am struck, and we're moving into the end of June, and so I do a bunch of 4th of July events, and I am struck by how laudable we look at the career of a military person, and I think that's accurate. I just returned from 1 week at the Army War College, where I was chosen with 160 other people to offer a civilian perspective to these, they were all lieutenant colonels and above, who were going for their master's program at the Army War College. And for the last week, they bring in, there's like 500 people nominated, and I was picked with 160. And there's 7 of us in there with 20 of these guys and gals who are lieutenant colonels and higher. And I was struck by the quality of the military we have, the commitment they've made. And I find myself wondering, what is the commitment of the citizenry? Where is that commitment? And it goes far beyond hanging a flag. It goes far beyond paying our taxes. And it goes far beyond the very small number of people who vote. And it's the real question as to whether our democracy will survive.
Right, but you know that there are some of us that are spending quite a bit of time. Even what we often find is that we get pulled in 50 different directions, trying to pay attention because everything is so compartmentalized. It makes it really tough to focus. But one of the things that I know this is an offshoot of where we started, but I'm just curious: how did you get picked for this group?
Well, how it works, to be honest with you, Melody, I was amazed and astounded that I got picked. But how it works is past members of the Army War College can nominate someone to go to the National Security Seminar. These guys and gals who, the military folks who are doing the Army War College, it's an intensive 10-month program where they walk out with a master's. We all know a master's usually takes 2 years. But that's what these folks are doing 7 days a week, 8 hours, 10 hours a day. It's a pretty impressive group. And how I got picked is a lieutenant colonel who I had met, who did 2 tours in Vietnam and 20 years in the Army. And he was a graduate of the Army War College program. His paper, by the way, is Why We Lost in Vietnam. This was many years ago he was there. He thought I would be a good fit. And he put the nomination together and sent it in and asked me if I had an interest after it was sent in. In the meantime, before it was sent in, he had worked out, he showed up in Salida, he lives in northern New Mexico, said, hey, I want you to meet a friend of mine. Well, this guy is a guy who lives in Colorado Springs, who's a retired three-star general. There's not that many of those guys around. And we sat and talked for half a day. And what I didn't realize is that was an interview. When that was done, the three-star wrote a stellar report as well, or a stellar recommendation that was attached to my nomination. Now, I don't know what the process was. There was 160 citizens chosen. I may have been the 160th. I don't know. As far as I could tell from the list of the 160 of us, I was the only, there was only one other elected official, and that was the lieutenant governor of Utah was there. There was also the agricultural commissioner from Texas. I am unclear if that's an elected or an appointed position. But there wasn't a lot of elected officials there. So that's how I got to the thing. But I was struck by the commitment these guys and gals have made, how much we think it's valuable to us, and yet the question I ask myself and why I ran for mayor, and the question I wish the other citizens would ask themselves, is given the tremendous commitment these folks have made, what can I do with the freedom that they afford us? What can I do to contribute to that? And I think that is a question that's not being asked, not since Kennedy. You know, I just don't think. I think we've become a little too caretaken and a little too in a sense of entitled.
Right.
And the government, you know, the government will take care of us till it doesn't, and then they're bad. Something that I think it was Vicky who said, it's, or maybe both of you guys said, that it's complicated and it's difficult and it's hard to find the time. Local government is not complicated, and it is not difficult to find the time, at least in Salida, and it is easy to get a hold of your officials. And it only takes a minute or two of conversation. So I would disagree here. One of the things we've done in the past 3.5 years is when I became mayor, we did have our meetings on a closed loop on the public access channel. Since then, they are now live in a closed loop, and we've actually had a few citizens who are watching on television going, oh my, look what they're talking about, and they hop in their car, hop on their bicycle, and rip down and that's part of a debate, which, you know, is not, the timing is not always going to work for that, but it cracks me up, and one of the advantages of it being live. We also have our work sessions that occur on the same day in the morning, which is not run by parliamentary procedure, so it's a much freer dialogue. And those are live, and they're on a closed loop. Our planning and zoning meetings are rebroadcast, and when we have special meetings, they're usually work sessions, they're broadcast. You know, if you contrast that to Chaffee County government, in our meetings, by the way, are at 6 in the evening when a lot of people aren't working. Chaffee County government, their meetings are noon, they're very poorly posted, and there's nothing videoed, and if you want a DVD, they charge you.
Really?
We also have, yeah, and we also, I should have continued, it's inconsistent as to where, when it goes in. For example, I was out of town last week attending an Army War College National Security Seminar, and the DVDs of the meeting that I missed end up in my box, and I deliver a copy to the library. So sometimes it's one day after the meeting, sometimes it's this week, it'll be a week after the meeting, but you can go to the library and get that. And then the minutes get published, usually they will get approved the next meeting, and in a meeting packet, those minutes are available. And I'm on KHN, as Melody knows.
Yes.
So Wednesday at 9 o'clock after each meeting. And then what Melody might not know is I'm on KVRH 7 in the morning, Monday through Friday.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, or not KVR. Yeah, KVRH. Now, the difficulty with that, and sometimes it becomes untopical, is, for example, I will go in Friday this coming Friday afternoon, and I will record Monday through Friday's pieces, and then they put them in, you know, by computer. So I have to be somewhat generic and general. I could be talking about something that I thought was going to happen that didn't happen, or something I didn't think was going to happen and did. But we have tried our best to be as transparent as possible, make it as accessible as possible. We've also, there was a wonderful guy in town who's very shy, and he would rather I not use his name, but he volunteered and completely, he did what he does professionally is website development, and he completely redid the website for the city of Salida, and it's far more accessible, and there's timely stuff on that as well. And also, I should mention, I write an article, usually it's the last week of each month, in the Mountain Mail. If there's something, for example, we suddenly have an increased fire danger and the fire chief wants to put something up, I might get bumped 1 week either side, but generally the last week. And those articles are on the city website, and they're also published in the Salida Citizen, which is a local website with information pertaining to Salida and beyond. So we're really making an effort to make it more accessible. When we are accused, as we often are, of not being a transparent government, the first sort of semi-snide comment I make is find a government that's more transparent, and I'll give you a buck. And the other is, a window's transparent, but you don't see anything if you don't look through it. And people expect a lot from their government without expecting much from themselves. And I feel so lucky to be have born in this country where I've had incredible opportunity, including the opportunity to run as mayor and to win. Everybody should have the opportunity to be on the other side of the dais and see how hard the staff is working. And to see to what degree, at least with this city council, these guys really work at trying to do the right thing. And it's been quite an honor. And it has been inconvenient, but public service, whether it's the military or being a cop or a paramedic as I used to be, it's inconvenient. It's just the way it is.
Can I take you back a little bit to that War College thing?
Take me anywhere you want.
What did you do at this? What went on at this event?
Sorry, I missed the last sentence.
Okay, what took place at this event?
Well, so keep in mind the chief thing we were tasked with was to engage and challenge the students. And this came directly from the Major General.
You might back off of your phone just a little bit. Okay.
Okay. This came directly from the Major General, who is commander of the War College. He says, we want you to challenge and engage the students. So you need to keep in mind that these students have been in the military virtually their whole life, And they have some perspectives of the citizen, but not all. And so, for example, the very first day, we had the students, which was roughly, 500 students, faculty, and 160 citizens. We were all divided into seminars, so I was focused on 20 military guys and 7 other citizens, more or less. And we were in their seminar room. But first, we would tootle down to the lecture hall, and there's a huge screen, and we got an Afghanistan update. And it was supposed to be given to us by Petraeus. However, President Obama requested his presence in D.C., because you may be aware that Petraeus is Obama's choice for a CIA director, and that's coming up. So he couldn't do it, so Nicholson, the second in command of our troops in Afghanistan, was live on the big screen giving us the update. Now, there was nothing classified, which you would expect. I have no classified documentation.
Right, right.
But it was a very coherent discussion of what was going on, and then we were able to ask questions. So there's 160 or 600 people in this room. This guy's a busy guy, as all these lecturers are. So there's about a half hour's worth of questions. And then you would retire to the seminar room, with your 20 military people, and I think my group was 8 citizens with them, and discuss what the general had said. And it was interesting. Firstly, it was a model of how dialogue, debate, and discourse should occur. It was not parliamentary procedure, but not once did I hear anybody attack a person. They attack the issues. And that's something as a citizenry we still haven't learned. And that's not just in Florida, that's everywhere. You know, you might hear someone say something disparaging about Newt Gingrich as a person, but I'll guarantee you he has an idea, too, that would probably be of value. And on the other side, you could take someone very liberal and say the same thing, and yet what we tend to hear is so-and-so said it, what they said must have no value because they said it. There was none of that. It was a much more issue-based, fact-based debate. The military was, and the military folks in the seminar on that particular topic are divided as to whether Afghanistan is going to be a success. And as an aside, for those who've read the book Obama's Wars, which is it's a sequel basically to Bush's Wars, done by Woodward of Woodward and Bernstein, the Washington Post. And basically, Obama becomes president and gets all the military, civilian, and military advisors together and said, why were we in Afghanistan? And no one could tell him. We'd been there for 8 years. No one could tell him. And these are the people who want to know. They're the ones who will ultimately someday be our generals and our civilian commanders. And as military people right now, they want to know what they're supposed to be doing. But there's no belief that what we're doing in Afghanistan is going to be successful by any measure. It's that dicey. And as to us getting out by 2013, that is probably an unrealistic view, and I think we've all known that. I mean, anyway, so that was the first day. And then there would be, you know, lunch, and you get back in the lecture hall, and there would be another topic. Not the lecture hall, but the seminar. There'd be another topic. The budget, for example. And it would be a very high-quality discussion. And then there would be either buffets or dinners each night and for lunch, and that would be an opportunity to get with people and get to know each other, and you would, as always, in these casual affairs, learn more than you would in a formal, meeting hall or educational situation. So that was a classic day. One of the days that was somewhat of an anomaly that was pretty wild is I'm a history guy, and I've always been. I have a degree in American Studies, but the focus was early colonial history and the Civil War. Well, this location is Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and that's where the Army War College is, which is about 30 minutes from Gettysburg. So one of the professors took our group to Gettysburg, and we walked through the Battle of Gettysburg. And it's pretty amazing. I mean,
I've had the opportunity to go there myself.
Yeah, it was the professor who made it alive. This guy's knowledge of history is unbelievable, and specifically that battle and the war, the Civil War. But as always, what I was struck by is what a lousy method of coming to agreement or asking or forcing someone to agree with you is go kill a bunch of people. And yet, I think we have to accept the fact that one historian estimates 29 years in the written history of man where there wasn't any wars. My guess is he just missed them. We have to accept the fact that we absolutely have to have a strong military because there's a lot of people out there who want to bend your way using force. One of the things we discussed, but anyway, that was a great experience. I had studied it, but had never been there. One of the things that was discussed quite a bit is, and no one really has an answer, is the military that we have right now is often described as based upon the old industrial military model. And the last industrial military war we had was World War II. And so it's an antiquated model. And what should the military evolve to? What should it look like? The classic cliched line from the military is we plan for the war we just fought, which means you're always a war behind. And we're surely there in Afghanistan and Iraq. And these men and women are frustrated. Most of them are going back to Afghanistan. But they'll do the best job they can with what they've got. And the thing is what are we doing there? And that's still being debated. And I think Obama can be given a lot of slack because he inherited it. And it's really tough to, you know, you make a mess, someone's got to clean it up. But anyway, that's one of the things. The other deal is we had a lovely lecture, not lovely, but very informative lecture about the drug cartel wars in Mexico. This is a security issue. And then, of course, we would discuss that. We had the keynote speaker, unrelated to me, is a guy named Gideon Rose, and he's written a book called How Wars End. And it was a fascinating lecture as well. So it was basically a very intense educational experience with the focus being the civilians, giving a civilian perspective on what the military is doing, specifically these folks. These guys and gals are going to leave the Army War College and be working for a general. So what the Army War College does for them is up to now they are tactical and focused, which is they'd say, Melody, go take that hill, and you would come up with a plan to take that hill with your people. Now with the Army War College, you're trying to turn them into strategic. In other words, they wouldn't be just looking at the battle, but the entire war. And so that's what the Army War College is supposed to offer them, as a way to learn the basics of strategy in a real world setting. Incidentally, everyone has been paying attention to Colorado politics, and government knows that the Department of Wildlife and Colorado State Parks, due to a bill sponsored in part by Gail Schwartz, our state senator, is now one department. And there was three people who put their resumes in to become director of this new department. And the guy who got it, Mr. Cables, who's a lifetime forester, went to the Army War College and got a master's there. It is open also to citizens who work for the government.
Now, which departments were combined? I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
What was combined in our state was Colorado State Parks and Department of Wildlife.
Oh, okay.
Or Division of Wildlife, pardon me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you have two guys in charge, and they needed to have one, so there was people put in their resumes, and there was the usual process. And I think his name's Rick Gables. He's the guy who got it. He is also a graduate of the master's program of the Army War College. Now, I'm not a master's. I was there for a week. Nobody can get a master's in a week, least of all me. I was just a member of the National Security Seminar, which is a small part of the master's program.
Now, one of the things that to draw kind of a correlation to what you're talking about and how they, you know, not only do they just plan the certain, how to carry out a certain order, but to look at the overall strategy, is what Vicki and I are trying to look at, and where our governments are headed, even though oftentimes it appears as though, you know, you're getting directed from the federal government, the state government, the county governments, or just, you know, deciding to do it on your own, that there really is that same sort of process going on with our governments, whether we realize it or not. And that's why we're trying to get a little better feel of those that are involved in the middle of the process.
Yeah, and also in terms of strategy, they combined your two departments, parks and animals. Are you hearing any discussion about having regional arrangements whereby they partner up with other states? Because animal habitat, of course, crosses state lines.
That's true, and that's one of the things that becomes confusing is federal land versus state versus local municipalities versus private. And they all have their specific purviews. Colorado State Parks is very well defined. And Division of Wildlife was. Division of Wildlife was completely funded by fees and permits that they collected for hunting and fishing. They were not tax-driven at all. And it'll be interesting to see how they come up with that. But, of course, they cannot do something that would be against. They can't choose to do something in a certain habitat that the federal government would determine would be a hazard or a risk to an endangered species, for example. None of us could. It's too early to tell what this, how this is going to work, but it is basically, you know, ladies, to back up to what you really want to talk about, and that is there a centrally driven agenda that is coming down to the municipalities, even one of the size of 5,300? I will say first, I think our citizenry is extremely confused. I am often accused by citizens of the same malfeasance and taking money from the insurance companies and all that stuff that happens in D.C. out in the open. What happens in a local government is not what happens in D.C. It's not the same animal. It looks like the same animal. It's the same structure. But what they've evolved to is, at least comparing Salida to what I read about what's happening in our House and Senate at the highest level, it's two different animals. And to it's really insulting to a city councilman getting paid $150 a month to be equated to some guy who's a millionaire to start with and has taken millions in lobbyist money. It's not something that's based in reality.
Well,
they're very rarely can be compared.
Yeah.
However, the thing that's happened is, you know, Salida became a town in roughly 1880. It was created by Denver Rio Grande Rail. And it was basically a company town. And so perhaps it's not the best example, but they kind of killed what they ate here. The economy was roughly local. I mean, transportation, even though they were a railroad town, was somewhat limited, especially early on. And I know there's exceptions to that. We used to grow a lot of lettuce in this valley, and it would get shipped all the way to New York City. But still, we ate mostly what was locally farmed and ranched here. And as an old person, I mean, you can read it every once in a while in our newspaper in their historic section. You know, if you were dying and you had no one to take care of you, you'd end up in the railroad hospital. There's a poorhouse that's now a bed and breakfast on a 160. And below that, there's a small building that when people who were in the poorhouse who had TB were isolated. There was a lot of there were social structures there to a certain extent, but they were all locally driven. When we start looking to the federal government to give us money to do things that the citizens want locally, how can we not be beholden to them? How can you not be beholden to anybody that you ask for something for virtually free, and when they give you the money, how can you not be beholden to them?
I think it's pretty much the other way around. The government offers money because they have an agenda in the redesign. You know,
so what you're saying is the tax money that we're sending to the feds is they're asking us for money, and that's the way it goes, right?
Oh yeah. Well, and then they turn around and use it as a carrot for an agenda for central planning that they are in fact implementing in this country.
Well, I think that's an interesting theory. I don't know in this state, but I know in Montana, I think for every buck of taxes that's paid to the feds, they get a buck and a half back. I know my old home state, New Mexico, for every buck that New Mexicans sent to the feds, they got almost twice that back. It was at the time I was in New Mexico about 10 years ago, they were getting almost twice back than what they paid. In Colorado, given the large, small population for the landmass, I would be very surprised if that's not also the case to a greater or lesser degree, but I do not know.
Well,
and, you know, that's my point. Is if you want something and you're willing to treat it as a pool, you're going to pay somebody that and hope that creates a synergy so you'll be taken care of. I also hear no one's going to take my Social Security away. I paid for that. Right? You guys hear that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we get our paperwork. I look at my paperwork. You know, I've been getting it since my 50s. And who knows if Social Security, I'm sure it will be here when I turn 65 4 years from now. But when I take a look as of today, the total amount of money that was sent to the feds for my Social Security that I sent and my employers sent Once I start collecting at 65, I think you have an option at 62. I'm not going to do that. And it might be 66. I don't remember the exact deal, the exact age. In 3 years, every penny that myself and my employers contributed will have been spent. So after 3 years, someone else is paying taxes to pay for my Social Security. So no, I did not pay enough for Social Security. When I entered college in 1968, the statistics were, why do I remember this, Melody and Vicki? It's scary. What you remember and what you don't. But in 1968, the average American male after retirement lived 2 years and died. That's not happening anymore, and it's putting a huge strain. So it goes back to, there might be a conspiracy. Melody and I have had this discussion. I don't think we work very well together, and that a conspiracy is very necessary.
Excuse me. This is not, what I just told you is not a conspiracy. You can find the information on the reinvention of government right on, you know, in the Clinton-Gore archives. So everything.
Well, describe to me how it's being. Describe to me how it's being reinvented, and I will tell you if I'm aware of it here.
Via the internet, they basically corporatized our government, meaning consolidation of systems. And I have the memos from the from Alice Rivlin, who was the director of OMB at the time, and then Franklin Rains took her place, and she gave the order to consolidate all of the financial systems of government. So, and I have the design of the National Human Resources Management System, which is the Integrated School Workforce Development System. So I have a whole website full of documentation where I have identified both the thinking behind it and the actions that they took, how they did it, the reinvention laboratories, who was involved in it, David Osborne, Ted Gabler. So this is not, I'm not talking to you about conspiracy theory. I'm talking to you about what they actually did.
Well, I still have to hear some specifics to know if they trickled down to our little town.
Do you have a council of governments?
We do, and you know what, Melody? I'm gonna say something bad about me. I am our municipal, the three municipalities in Chaffee County. I am our delegate. And it's one of the two boards that I'm on that I just had to not attend. The meetings were outside of the county. They were 4 to 6 hours long, and honestly, I didn't see that much of the information pertained to what we had going on. And I was busy enough without adding another half day. One thing you learn as an elected official, at least one thing I've learned, and as well-meaning people want to spend your time, and, you know, the council's paid $150 a month, I'm paid $250 a month, and, you know, I can put 20 to 60 hours in a week. And so we have a council of governments. I do not attend those meetings. And they, as far as I can tell, have little effect directly on Salida. I mean, the exception to that right now is a little war going on between our community center, used to be the senior citizen center, and the director of COG here regarding the meals for the seniors and Meals on Wheels. And that's one of those really specific little things that when I was called to see what I could do about it, it honestly sounded to me to be a personality issue. And it's very distressing when it gets down to personality issues rather than the seniors need services, let's work together and get it done.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes that just happens. We're people.
Yeah.
And most of the things I've seen locally when people say city or county government employees suck and they made a mistake is what people forget is government, just like the private sector, is made of people, and people make mistakes all the time. Not just in the government, but also in the private sector. The thing is, in the private sector, it's not as visible. And that's not an excuse. We don't want people to make mistakes, but it's part of being human. And I really, it bums me out when we start dealing with personalities, he said, she said, rather than This is our goal. These are the issues. Let's ignore the personalities and get the job done.
Well, I have to.
So,
We just had the same issue here in Twin Falls. And as a matter of fact, I got involved in it accidentally. I did end up testifying in front of the city council, and the issue, of course, was whether the senior center should remain a senior center to serve seniors, or whether it should become a community center. And I know that was the same issue that you had going on in your town, right?
No, it's a permutation of that. The real thing we have is the senior citizens are unable or unwilling to fund the services offered. And so this might go back to how do larger governments end up dictating to smaller governments. And so what they do is they look for money, and they look for funds, and it's the Council of Governments that had the money and the funds to provide these meals. Well, when you sign a contract, you dance to that contract. And the contract, my understanding, became onerous for a variety of reasons. As far as the community center was concerned, and that's what caused this little battle. Previously, what happened is the senior citizen center simply was not economically feasible. And so the senior citizen center board decided on their own to enlarge their scope. So now they offer their building as a meeting hall and for events and wedding receptions and that sort of thing. So that was the choice, and this is the sort of thing that I admire. They had a problem, and the city did get involved. It is on city property, and it is actually a city building. But it has been, they pay $1 a year for the lease of the thing, and it's really been their baby. And I admire the fact that they saw they had a financial problem, and they tried to broaden their base to deal with it. Whether they'll be successful, only time will tell.
Yeah. No, you just repeated exactly the situation here.
The difference is, you know, the city council has nothing to do with this directly. It's the board of the community center that's making these decisions, and that's how it should be, in my opinion.
You know, Chuck, I have to commend you on the fact that, you know, what I glean from what your view of where I'm coming from, and I see that, you know, there's a lot of disagreement there, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with that, because what I'm
just... That's good. It's scary if we all agree on everything.
Right, and when I got involved in this sort of thing, I had my own family and everybody else, you know, going, well, what are you doing here? And
that's also a good sign. Yeah.
But my main thing is to be asking the questions and looking and stepping back and looking at the bigger picture, because that's, I don't know, this is something I must have been born with, and I'm always looking for where the catch is. And I don't know, you know, you want to call it conspiracy or whatever, but there's just, I don't, it must be in me genetically, I don't know. But
well, I wouldn't worry about it if you're happy with it. I mean, we all play the cards we're dealt with. I do think that, how big is Twin Falls, Vicky? I forget.
Oh, it's about, there's about 30,000 people, I think, somewhere.
Yeah, the scale gets a lot bigger, but we're a little town of 5,300, and technically a city. There's a difference between a city and town according to the state constitution. We're technically a city, but for anyone who's lived in a city, this is a town. And I personally think government is really accessible if you try to gain information. Now, at the same time, it's fascinating what I've learned, and I did not know this. Maybe I intuitively knew it, but it was not clearly articulated. There's a method to make things work, to just gain information. Most people, like you, wait. The first week of July, we're having a significant water rate increase. People are going to go in and just be so rude and nasty to the staff that collects the water bill money. It's really just horrible to watch. I might sit in the lobby and remind people that they need to be courteous regardless of what they think. What people don't get is staff implements the policy made by the elected officials. So if the elected officials, for some reason, decide, we're going to make a law that all guys have to wear skirts on every Tuesday, you don't go after the employees. You go after the city council. Those are the people you ask your questions to, and you make people make them aware that you're unhappy. But right away, when I see how our city staff is treated, I understand that people don't get how government works. The other thing, and I don't know about Twin Falls, by the time you come to a city council meeting and the issue is on the agenda, it has been discussed, unless it's a very minor issue or an emergency issue, it has been discussed ad nauseum by staff and elected officials in several other public meetings. And it is really tough to be heard in our city council meetings for two reasons. One is there's certain things that have to get done. And so there's time limits on how long you can talk. There's a limit to how much dialogue can occur. We are using parliamentary procedure. We're using Robert's Rules of Order. And that is confining, although it also directs the conversation towards an end. And the thing to do is to get a hold of your city councilman or your mayor and say, not you guys are really wrong and you're a bad person for deciding this, but rather say, can you explain this issue to me? And what you've done there is you've opened a dialogue. Where to do what Glenn Beck and these other guys do, where they just attack people, it may be entertaining and it may make people feel good, but you're not going to hear what you need to hear and you're not going to get done what you want to get done. You've created an adversarial relationship, and you can have differing views on issues, and you may even dislike the person, but that person you dislike might have the answer that's going to be perfect to address the problem you have. And we shut off discourse by coming in with both safeties off and guns firing.
It's
crazy.
The reason why I brought up, even though you may not be attending the Council of Governments and you may not be seeing why it even exists, there is something going on behind this, and whether. Whether it's apparent or transparent or whatever, that's why we're asking these questions, to find out how much it has become a part of our lives, just like with the international building codes as opposed to the old UBC. I mean, there's a reason why they're going international, and sometimes it's not the warm and fuzzy that we're told. And that's...
I agree. And, you know, one of the things that's...
Have you implemented those international codes?
We are under the 2006 IBC. Now, the county, I may have it wrong, but the county's about to adopt the 2008. And we do not have our own building department. The building department of the county is contracted with us. They basically get the permit fees to do the building inspections and the plan inspections. However, the city of Salina, have you ever been to Chaffee County, Vicki?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's a county of 17,000. Probably the only place more beautiful is Idaho Falls. Did I say the right thing?
Twin Falls,
Idaho. Anyway, I don't really know, but I thought I'd throw that out there. Anyway, it's a place of 17,000. Our town is the largest, 5,300. There's a town of 400, and there's a town of 2,500. The rest live in the unincorporated portion of the county. And back to the cog melody, what happens is when you have a bunch of small governments, they will group together to try and get the grants and the funding to get things done they could not otherwise get done. You do end up beholden to these larger entities, and you do end up operating on their agenda. It is sometimes a bad thing, and is always way too much paperwork. But the city of Salina, for us to be able to build I'm trying to remember what it is, I think it's a $14 million wastewater treatment plant. That's simply not going to happen. The citizens of, you know, we have roughly, including Poncha Springs, that we regionalize the wastewater sewer system, Vicki, to include our smaller neighborhood, 400 Poncha Springs, 2,900 sewer hookups. You know, dividing that by 20 years, 13 million over 2,900 sewer hookups, that's just, you just can't afford to do it, so you have to go to these larger entities. There's times where you have to do that.
Yeah, it does. I don't disagree with you on that, but so you are in some areas a metropolitan area of the county. Is that correct?
Well, we would be the chief city of the county. It also is where the county seat is, and it's where the bulk of the population is. As so often happens, we are in the far southeastern corner of the county, so we are not necessarily that convenient to the other second largest municipality of 2,500, Buena Vista. However, to give you an idea of the small space of this county, Buena Vista is 25 miles away, so it's not that bad. You know, driving time is a fraction of what most people spend in their commute in most cities. It's about 25 minutes to a half hour. But, you know, we are the economic driver of this county. That's just the way it is. I guess I'm still unclear. Vicki, you cited the names and all that, but I guess, and Melody, you were talking about council of governments and how that could have some insidious force. Yeah, go ahead.
What I'm seeing take place, and this isn't, you know, again, I'm not making this up. I just received almost a 4-inch thick book put together by a lady that has been working in this arena since the 50s. And this information even goes back, that she's included in here, goes back to the 30s. And when she has stated and put in the actual newspaper articles and the actual copies of the documents and legislation and the things connecting the dots to show that there is an agenda in place, but unless you can stand back and look at the total picture, most of us would never, ever recognize that there could be such a thing. But then when I had done some interviews with a lady who had gone to well over 100 world meetings on her own and listened to these people that were the dignitaries from around the world talk about what they were planning and how they were planning, and this went anywhere to the monarchies, to the bankers of the world, to the leaders of the world, she would show up to these events, and she started piecing together what they had on their mind. And these guys, when she counted them, she said there was over 5,000 of these groups and organizations that were meeting. And
so what did they have on their minds?
This was creating a global government. One, you know, a global government that works under a singularity. But in order to do it, they knew it was going to be a huge undertaking. And so they had to start figuring out ways to break it down in doable chunks. And so they did do that. But again, being able to pick over at least 100 years that I'm finding this goes back to, but it may even be further than that they started taking planting and getting people into academia, the economy, the military, the local governments, the regional governments, the world governments. They started getting people involved that would work with their planned agenda. And what they did a lot of is they changed the names of things. So what in one place you would call a socialist, another one would call a Democrat. or you would call a liberal a socialist or a Democrat. I mean, they started playing word games, and you started, you start picking up on a doublespeak taking place. Then you start going back to their documents and even the books and theater and movies. You can start back deconstructing what's going on. And this is what I have been trying to do. And Vicki's doing a much better job at it because she's digging into a lot of the computer avenues and broader spectrum of what I have been doing, reaching over different processes. So,
well, yeah, the computer systems become important only because they are a tool to keep track of the aggregate data and management systems to, manage all of the entities that are included in, whatever system it is that you're talking about. But if you go back to what you said, I believe you said a statutory city, the rules for statutory cities are set by the state legislature. Did I get that correct?
Yeah, and there's a reason for that, Vicki. If you can imagine in the 1800s, there's a gold strike and suddenly have 500 people in one place and you want to become a city mm-hmm. or a town, rather than have to go through the work of creating a charter, they could say we're a statutory city and they would just follow the city statutes or the town statutes. So it was a time saving. We even have one city, and I always forget if it's Fort Morgan or Georgetown in Colorado, that is operating under the charter that's territorial. It's the same charter that was put in place for that municipality before Colorado became a state. So one could say we're conservative and slow to move here at times.
Well, okay. But now, if you take that concept whereby the state legislature sets the rules, defines your ordinances, does everything for you. Okay, now, if you look at the capability of what computers can do nowadays, you could have all of your cities governed by the rules that the state legislature passes so that everything is the same, everything is standard, everybody's all marching to the same drummer.
Well, you could, except what I should say is this was done in the 1800s, so it was for a fully, completely different reason.
Right,
and also,
right.
We're one of the few statutory cities that still exist.
Right.
Almost, I think there's like 14 of them or 10 of them still in the state. So they could do that, but it's doubtful. And also, just for clarity, a statutory city, that's our charter. But we have tremendous latitude still. We just don't have the same latitude that a home rule city.
I was just using that, to get the concept out there. But in fact, the federal government is doing that kind of thing, and they are pushing this agenda down to the states. I've got a contract that the state of Oklahoma signed with a company called Capgemini, where they were doing analysis on all of the state software, hardware, and the functions performed by the state systems to segregate out the commodity functions, what they call the commodity functions, for the purpose of taking those functions and putting them up in the cloud, which is really kind of a silly concept. The cloud, there's no such thing as a cloud. All they're doing is really putting it onto a server where the state commodity functions will be aggregated for all of the states. Okay, now that's redesign of government, where you have your state functions collectivized.
I agree. I wonder what the actual reason for this is. I mean, some of what's going on, I have to believe, is, and Melody and I have talked about this locally, is trying to come up with a way to, in a county of 17,000, if we don't work together in the county, we're going to be really stuck in terms of what our economy of scale is too small to just do some of the things the citizens want. And there's two answers to that. The first thing is maybe what the citizens want, they should take care of themselves. And it goes back to this very basic discussion that is really prevalent now under this fiscal strain that everyone, citizens and government, is feeling. And that is, what's the job of government? What's the job of government? And so there's that balance to be made locally. And also this idea that not just individually do I feel entitled, but I especially think small governments feel entitled. And they feel that the state or the feds ought to pull us out of mistakes that we have made. And or just situations that we shouldn't have, that we found ourselves in and we can't afford to get ourselves out of. And that's where that becomes insidious. And we actually have had cities that have been taken over by state governments because they were bankrupt. And so, you know, I don't know what you gals are talking about or what your research is specifically. It's hard for me to imagine that it started with the Clinton era, but that if it's something that's real, and I have to believe you guys are telling me it is to a certain degree, it had to have started before that.
Oh, no, way before.
Question is, what is the intent? And what's the intent? Is it something insidious, or is it just an attempt to bring a new scale to something so services are more affordable?
Well, you know, there are those that are going to think that it is, that, you know, that it's insidious, and there are those that are going to think that it's a great thing, that it's the answer to the, you know, the world's problems. So
actually, Melody, it depends on what level you're talking about.
Right.
If you're talking about a local little town like what you're living in Salida, then what you're talking about are efficiencies and things that make sense. When you're talking about global governance, you know, where the American government cedes sovereignty to international committees and to an international body, then you're talking about something entirely different. So
right, you really are. Those are two entirely different discussions, although they surely relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a wonderful book. There's a guy named Jared Diamond. He wrote Germs, Guns, and Steel. But his most recent book is Collapse. And it's a fascinating book because what he looks at, what the subtitle of it is Why Societies Fail or Succeed. And, you know, it's really easy to look at. What we know is whether you believe in global warming or not, whether you believe that we had a mini ice age in the late 1700s and early 1800s, when you have a significant weather change, and you've already stressed the environment, usually by overuse, something's going to happen, and very often those societies fail. And yet there's societies like New Guinea, the interior of New Guinea, that society existed for 34,000 years because of their environmental awareness. It's fascinating. And it's one of those things with all the people we've placed on the planet right now. The strains are there where we're going to look for answers in the economy of scale. And that's not going to work. You know, it's not going to work. There's too many of us with too few resources. One of the things that I'm noting, and this is, I think, is a parallel track to what you ladies are talking about, is you can go into any third world country, and these people have access to television, and they're watching Lindsay Lohan and all these other crazy people walking around with way too much money doing crazy things. And they want to do that, too. Well, our country creates, what are we using, 40 to 30% of all the energy resources. We create 30% of the waste, and India is up there, Europe's up there, China is going to outstrip all of us. And we're trying to bring third world countries, and they're introduced, I'm afraid, to our society by television. They want the same thing we've got. They want 2.5 televisions for the house, and they want McDonald's. And so when they start using stuff at the same rate we are, something's going to have to break.
You know,
and those are big issues. And I'm really at a loss as to how you...
Okay, all right. Let me address this a little bit, and from my, just the perspective that I'm looking at, is some of the leadership that has been involved in the current main countries, wealthy countries, have gone into these other countries that didn't have a lot of these things, and now they're taking and developing these countries. And yet at the same time, when they leave behind the guilt and the idea that we're here trying to rape the planet, take all the resources, and not be mindful of our environment, is flies in the face when you watch them go into these other countries, and then they start going to the excesses and utilizing their resources and polluting, and then looking to us to try to answer some of these problems for them. So I stopped trying to feel guilty about my recycling or whatever. And it's not that I'm not saying that we shouldn't be doing this. We should have been doing all that. Why do we have plastic in the first place? We were recycling things. We were doing a lot of these things. And all of a sudden, we've got this marketing mess that, it has just become much more than most of us want to deal with. But there it is. And now they're over in other countries doing the same thing. And
that's the hypocrisy,
right?
When I was a kid, that's where I got my spending money, is turning in pop bottles, and so. But that's the hypocrisy of the environmental movement and the philosophy that the United States needs to export wealth, bring up the standard of living to these other countries because we use too many resources. So therefore, we need to deprive ourselves to give to these other countries that could not keep trow zipped. So I don't know.
Well, we may be in disagreement, but I will tell you that what I would like to see is a change in the definition of standard of living to quality of life. And I can tell you personally that the quality of my life is not impacted by not having 2.5 televisions.
And we're not saying that either. We're really not trying to say that.
I agree, but the thing that happens is, in the big picture, I think the ultimate question that will be asked 50 years from now by the historians is, does a free market system work without strong regulation from a powerful government? This global recession occurred because the free market was not being regulated to the degree that it should have, in my opinion. And yet, they're still fighting like crazy, the Wall Street guys, to not be regulated. It just seems crazy to me.
But see, it was regulated.
It was regulated, but the regulations, how you make the regulations ineffective is you don't give the regulators enough money to have enough people or enough time to do the job. And
right.
And so the regulations were there, but people weren't. Anyway, there was also other stuff going on as mm-hmm. well. When things are going really well, nobody wants to stop what seems to be successful, even if everybody knows that when you're levered to the max, ultimately that's fake money and it goes away. Every great recession has been caused by over-leveraging. It doesn't take a genius. That's what the economists say. It doesn't take an economist to know that. But I guess what my point is we have globalized the world. If you look at the demise of some society, even as late as the mid-1900s, some of these isolated societies, they could blow up and cease to exist, and it really wouldn't affect any of us. But that world is over, in my opinion. We are a global community, whether we like it or not, and this country was largely the driver of that because we wanted to increase the markets to sell our stuff. And now we got to live with it.
Well, Chuck,
it's going to be a tough thing to deal with.
The interesting part about that statement, though, while you're saying that, is that we're being our industry has been shipped over abroad, and we are not. And so to sit there and put us into that arena is not us so much, because those companies are now global companies, and they're not necessarily United States companies.
So, well, no, they anyway, that's true. There's another irony to that, of course, and that is it was those of us in the middle class who wanted stuff cheap who went to places that sold it cheap, and it was cheap because it was made somewhere other than this country. So basically, we sold our own jobs out of the country.
I'm not entirely sure of that.
What's really fun to do is to look at everything you buy in 2 weeks except for food and see Made in the USA off and you see that label.
Well, it's almost non-existent.
It's pretty much non-existent. So who was buying the cheaper stuff? It was those of us in the middle class who had manufacturing jobs.
Who negotiated the trade agreements that allowed our markets to be flooded with this cheap stuff?
Well, that's true. NAFTA had some real negative aspects, but not if you were someone who wanted to sell your goods, you know, out of the country. And one of the things we sold was our job. It's really too bad.
Okay, Vicki, why don't you get into the foreign trade zone? Do you think that would apply here to kind of bring that?
I'm not sure what, I mean,
okay,
you know.
All right.
I mean, we don't have a lot of, I mean, we don't do that directly in the city of government of Salida. We do a little bit, but there's not a lot of that going on.
But do you have a law in Colorado concerning intermodal commerce zones at transportation hubs?
You know, if so, I'd be unaware of that, Vicki. That would largely be in play on the Front Range, which is the Piedmont to the east of the major mountain chain here. We are in the mountains. One of the great challenges we have is we're an extra day from everywhere, and people don't want to wait that extra day now, so we're pretty much eliminated from the possibility of having even light industry here, unless it's extremely boutique, like custom bicycles or something like that. If that's going on here, I'm unaware of it. What I can tell you is we have state enterprise zones where you offer manufacturers and other business people specific tax advantages to locate in your area, but I think 74% of the state are enterprise zones. So what happens is you create something to give someone an advantage. Everybody grabs it, which means everyone's at the same place. So it becomes no advantage at all. It's kind of a crazy deal. It's an attempt to gain an advantage over other municipalities, and it doesn't work. It would be better if we found a way to work together.
Okay, well, the other question I'd like to ask is about the watershed and management of the land by watershed. Are you familiar with that concept at all?
Well, to a certain degree. Now, you are in Idaho, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I came from New Mexico. The water law there was really based on Spanish law, because, you know, New Mexico was originally, after the Native Americans, the first white people, and there were conquistadors, and then it was a Spanish, under the King of Spain. Colorado law is very unique to me. One of the things they did is, and I know Montana is somewhat similar, is prior use is what determines the priority of water rights. And what they tried to do is make it so a few landowners couldn't tie up a river and no one else could get water. So just because you have land up against the river, if someone had already run a ditch and was getting water from that, they still have the right to that water. It's very complicated, and I am not that fluent. That's why as a municipality you end up with a water attorney and a water engineer to try and, I mean, it makes the Bible seem simple, trying to figure out this water law. But I don't know if I can answer your question, but I'll surely try.
Do we have anything, have you run across us being into the FEMA flood zones or FEMA?
Well, you know, I haven't. What I can tell you, however, is there's certain grants that we have considered in the city. and I'm not sure what they were for. It could be our wastewater treatment plant, where they don't want the plant sited within like the 100-year floodplain or the 500-year floodplain or the 50-year floodplain. And I know our land use plan, and I don't remember the specific issue, but I think it might have even been a 500-year floodplain. Well, the Arkansas Valley is a 500-year floodplain. And, you know, basically, the entire town's within a 500-year floodplain. And we all chuckled at that. But, no, I think where we have, we do have disaster planning. There's a county plan that has been underway for years. Due to the city's frustration with the lack of formulation of a county plan, we have a very able fire chief, and he's been quite active in creating a city plan and actually implementing the hardware to pull that off and the software as well, and training elected officials and staff. And we would interact with FEMA. But, you know, a town of 5,300, we're not really on FEMA's radar. They're really worried about the much larger municipalities with the much greater disasters. We did take a public elected official's course that would make us eligible for FEMA money should something bad happen. So it's on our radar, but it's mostly within the responsibility area of the fire chief.
But you are hooked into the national, what is it, the National Incident Management System,
yes,
or whatever that is?
Yes. Yes, we are.
Uh-huh. And yeah, where's the city going on the hot water issue?
So tell me a little more.
I'm just saying, you know, with what you're doing with the hot springs now, where are they? What have they
got
there?
Okay. Well, let me give Vicki a little background. A billion years ago, and that's a slight exaggeration, the city of Salida bought over 100 acres above the town of Poncha Springs, which is roughly 7 miles to the west of town, southwest of town. And during the WPA, they were looking for people to do work, and they dug, hand-dug, a water line to a swimming pool in the city of Salida, so we have a hot springs pool. It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I laugh. I think if someone came to me right now and said, hey, I've got a great idea, 6-mile pipeline, so you can, we'd go, are you crazy? But this was done in 1938. So the city had owned that land for a period of time before that project. And on it, there's a geothermal site. We are in a rift valley, the Rio Grande Rift. This is a relatively active earthquake zone. The valley on the other side, to the south of us, the San Luis Valley, actually has some fault lines that are through glacial till that's only 10,000 years old. In the glacial time, that's a snap of a finger. So this is a pretty active in geologic time zone. And when you have those active zones, you have potential for geothermal, and we do have hot water at the ground and on the ground surface. So we've gotten a grant, and this was originally from the governor's energy office, something started by our past governor, Ritter, in an effort to increase alternative energy creation and research for our state. We have had a grant. We've had a series of grants. We compiled all the data that had been put together since the 60s on this largely surface data, and then we got another grant, and this summer we're going to drill, I'm not sure how many, I think it's 3 to 5 wells, 300 to 500 feet deep, and they're not water wells. Ideally, they're dry wells, but you determine the temperature of the ground given at a given depth. And then if that comes out promising, what we do is you get another grant, because this is very expensive. We're talking millions of dollars to drill the next project. You drill a 1,000-foot hole, more or less. And what you're looking for is how hot is the water, how quickly does it recharge, and it just its rate of flow. And what we would love to see, and who knows, this is science. If the scientific data doesn't support it, it can't happen. We would like to see something similar to what Thermal Utah did, and that is create a geothermal, this is years and years out, like 10, 20 years out, but a geothermal power plant. Or rather than the fine citizens of Salida writing checks to Excel in Minnesota, and I'm from Minnesota, but I'd rather us keep our money locally, we would create a local utility where we're making our own electricity for our own use here, and therefore driving our own economy, not an economy elsewhere. That would be the hope, but the science has to prove it out, and we are a long way in terms of research to know if that's the case. Does that answer your question, Melody?
Yeah, worst case, though, couldn't you use the hot water for heat? I had the, when I lived in California, I lived in one place that had hot water baseboard heat, and I have no idea how it worked, but it was really nice heat.
It's really nice heat. Yeah, I've lived in a home with that. Right now, we just finished a $440,000, actually it was more than that, it was $440,000 from the Department of Local Affairs, and this was a grant that we got well over 3 years ago, maybe 3.5 years ago even. I was mayor, but I was a new mayor at the time, plus $325,000 that the city had, for reasons that we don't have to go into here. And the old water line got arterial sclerosis and got clogged up, and then they engineered a new line, which was poorly engineered and dropped at water temperature to where we had to heat the water, which is costly. And we just put in a new insulated line, and I forget the last time I heard the hot water was coming in at 115 degrees. We're cooling it for the lap pool, for example. So we have not looked at other options in terms of how to use the water besides the pool or for energy, largely because we still have to assess with this new refurbishment of the water line how much hot water and how hot it is to determine what we can do with it. As it was, there was not enough hot water to do much more than supply the pool. As the temperature rises, even though the rate of flow won't rise, we might be able to do something more with it. There's also water rights issues in the state. You know, you just can't willy-nilly use water. But at this point, this project was only completed 2-3 weeks ago, so we still need to get the data. And largely a year's worth of data, because when the irrigation system's going on, when people are irrigating, that's when the hot water really gets cool, because it acts as a form of air conditioning for those hot water lines, that's why they're insulated. So we'll find out. We might be able to use it for something else. The schools talk to us about heating their new building with the water from the hot water site, but we, at this point in time, don't know if there's enough water to do that. So all these things are being considered, but we don't have the data yet to know if it's feasible.
Okay, so the information that I had heard then may have been incorrect, or is it the heat or the amount of water or both that you're saying there isn't enough of?
No, what I'm saying is we don't know.
Okay.
In the old water line, that iron ductile, we call it a cold water line. There was definitely there wasn't enough hot water to heat the pool. We had to
put
on several heaters. So what we need to do now is see, as I say, this project was only completed 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And you know, Melody, you live here. You know how crazy it's been with the weather. It's hard to project when we will have the coolest, when the water will be coolest this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take some data. And one thing this council is really trying not to do is move forward with a good idea that is not based in fact. That's how you waste money. And that, you know, the water line we had to replace is an illustration of that.
Okay,
So first we'll get the data before we make a move.
Okay, there's.
I will no longer be mayor by many years.
Well, and I wanted to approach that a little bit on what your plans were later, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, whether we agree or not, I certainly appreciate the fact that you are accessible and that you are willing to talk about subjects that you know, you may not necessarily agree with, and to look into some avenues so that we can further assess what is going on and how it ties down to us locally. But are you familiar with the term of ICLEI, or the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives?
You know, I'm familiar with the term, but I can't tell you what the initiatives are.
Okay. All right. Well, and that's fine. Because there's certain cities, and I think there's not even a handful in the state that are involved in this particular group, but
well, I can give you an example. I had a group that approached me And Melody knows this, Vicki. I moved to this town from a place where I lived in the country, largely so I didn't have to drive a car, so I could walk and ride a bike. And they approached me to, all I had to do was sign a piece of paper to make Salida one of the bike-supporting cities, you know? Well, I'd love to do that, but the truth of the matter is I can't do that without the council agreeing on it. And it's one of those things that I triage, because what do you get from it? You know, you get, they can use your name in an article. I mean, what it's more important to me that we maintain the accessibility to all forms of transportation in this city. And the negative way to put it is most towns are designed for the convenience of cars, not people. I don't want Salida to evolve to that. Right now we are convenient for everybody, regardless of their mode of transportation. And so I chose to not even go to the council with that. Because what I don't want to do is create an appearance that we support something and then we do nothing. That's worse than supporting the wrong thing. At least then you'll learn from your mistake. I'm not really into symbolism at this point. I want to see something get done. And on the other side of that is what the real question still is being asked by the bulk of the citizenry is, we need this as citizens. How can government provide it? I think the bigger question is, and by the way, they don't want to pay any more taxes, right?
Right.
Well, as revenue reduces, the real question we have to ask as citizens is not even what are the core, not to approach it from what are the core services we want government to provide, but rather, what services can I do without? And one of the arguments that's bothersome, to me anyway, is people say, I had to let go five people from my business because of the recession. The government needs to feel the same sacrifice. I want them to let go of five people. Well, they had to let go of five people because they weren't doing the business to support them. The work of government, when times get bad, increases because everyone knocks on their door and says, save me. And that's not inappropriate, but we need to recognize it costs something. And so what I prefer people to do is to say, these are the services I no longer need. And they come to your government with that. And the government says, okay, if they find it feasible, what the government should do is to reduce the staff or eliminate the staff for those services that the population says they don't need. And then everybody goes away and we fulfill their obligation of being fiscally responsible.
Yeah, and I I thoroughly understand that. It'd even be kind of nice to know just, you know, if there is a list available of what all the, you know, the government is providing here. And so
that, well, that's funny you say that, because you can tell we're doing it well if people don't know what it is. When you do something well, it's invisible. You know what I mean?
Well, I know there's stuff that you do, but I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that we are not aware of, and that's...
Well, you can't be. You know, unless you like going down to the wastewater treatment plant and talking to Randy about chemicals and all this stuff, why would you want to know that? What you want to know is you flush your toilet and it disappears and it doesn't follow the river that the water ultimately goes into. That's what you want to know.
And I'd like to know that they're not recycling some of the water back into the drinking water.
Well, there's places in this state that are doing that.
We're aware of that. Right.
Well, it depends. You know, it's not scary as long as everything works. But one of the very contentious issues we had here as a city, Vicki, is we instituted a watershed protection ordinance. And, oh, man, you know, of course, our watershed extends far beyond the city. And the argument from those who didn't want it is the EPA, a federal entity, and Colorado Public Health and Environment, they're already doing that. But the fallacy behind that is if someone inadvertently really fouls the water that comes to our water treatment plant and wrecks it, they're going to get a violation from the EPA and from the Colorado State. But they're not going to have to help at all to repair to the tune of how many hundreds of thousands our plant, where with this ordinance we can't. And I think that's responsible government. Recognizing that we do have rights as landowners, and these would be the landowners who have land in our watershed but outside of the city. But what we don't talk about much in the West is we also have responsibilities. And the history of the West is not John Wayne. People forget he was an actor. It wasn't real. But it's a communal effort from a group of people working together who did not always like each other is how the main occupations that we still idolize in the West, ranching, mining, all those kinds of things. People would not survive without a communal effort.
Now, is
and
that,
we need to return to that.
Was that watershed effort, is that a local, regional, national, what is...
That's the city.
Just city
that's
alone.
City. And, Buena Vista, Melody already had one.
Mm-hmm.
The ranchers felt it was really onerous. We changed it. The key feature is any activity going on today is legal. But what we were concerned about was somebody deciding to start some kind of mining operation using, you know, hydrology, using water and mining. And all of a sudden, the South Arkansas, which is our major water source, is so silted up that it wrecks our treatment plant. Or somebody inadvertently dumps a bunch of fertilizer or something like that in there. We need to have the right to stop that. And I don't mean call the EPA up and have them get here in a week, but I mean within hours. And we need to have the right to demand that they aid us in the repair and replacement of what was damaged by their irresponsible activity.
Right, unless they declare bankruptcy or you know, keep you in court, and so you end up losing on that end.
Well, you know, that's an interesting deal, and I will tell you one thing I've learned as mayor is, as an elected official, you'll often hear us invoke, well, we're deciding not to do this or that because we don't want to get sued.
Mm-hmm.
You can't live your life like that. If you need
I'm not saying not to. I'm just saying that I've watched that policy work.
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as I know, in the past 3.5 years, we haven't lost a lawsuit.
Okay.
And we've only brought one, and that was the Poncha Springs wastewater treatment lawsuit. And that was ultimately fixed out of court. But what Vicki doesn't know is that was a battle between two main municipalities. It went for 40 years. And only when this council said, okay, all methods of negotiation have been exhausted, let's sue them. All of a sudden, as the mayor of Poncha Springs, a good friend of mine, said, he goes, well, that got our attention. And we actually sat down and negotiated a reasonable settlement for both parties. So I'm not afraid of that, but I know what you're saying. The thing is unfortunately, most of these violations are unintended and accidental, and yes,
mm-hmm,
everyone will be left holding their bag to a certain degree, but it gives us an opportunity to find the problem and get it fixed right away rather than waiting for the feds or the state to tool in.
Well,
and as tax revenue diminishes, they're going to have less money to do it, so we'll have to be more reliant upon ourselves.
Would that law allow you to stop mining operations from fracking?
Well, that's a good question. That's not an issue where we are, Vicki. We don't have that kind of resource. That is a very, I don't know about Idaho. You know, Wyoming right now, the Bitterroot Valley is being significantly impacted by the water quality of the Bitterroot, and elsewhere in Montana is being significantly impacted by the fracking that's happening in Wyoming. And what is not advertised is the damage it does to the water supply.
Right.
Fracking is a very water-intense operation, and it creates wastewater that is not healthy water. And that is not an issue where we are here. And, you know, the underlying issue there and the chief issue there is, are we willing to reduce the use of petroleum? And are we willing to find other ways to live and other ways to create energy? That's the underlying deal.
You know, part of that, though, is they're not necessarily fracking for petroleum, but fracking for natural gas.
Yeah, but it's all energy. All energy. I mean, Xcel, I think, is mistakenly, rather than refurbing a coal-fired plant, which they can be refurbed to where, you know, the emissions are negligible, they're putting in a natural gas electric generating plant, which, what do you think that's going to do to the price of natural gas you're using to heat your home?
Right.
And so I think it's all tied. And we are really going far afield from the topic you ladies want. It's like when people say, I don't understand why what happens in the Middle East affects us in this country in terms of the price of gas, because we don't get much gas from the Middle East. And that's true. However, what happens is if Sarah Palin had her way and we drilled every ounce of oil out of North America for our use, what OPEC would do is they'd reduce their creation of petroleum to keep the prices up.
Right.
Because the worldwide market, what happens there affects us directly. And it's not like it used to be, you know, where the oil came out of Pennsylvania or Texas and we used it here. It's a global market. It's a completely different world from my father's world. You know, and he's 90 years old, but it's a whole different world. Very short period of time,
I
think.
No, it. I mean, it's a good idea to know where our, you know, how our mayor thinks, and even though it isn't necessarily pertaining to mayoral issues. But I just had one more question before you just give us a little idea what you plan on doing when you leave office, and I certainly hope that you know, help. I mean, plan on being in, you know, involved in local government in some form, or at least getting the information out to the public, because, you know, I don't recall this being done on an individual basis to the extent that you have. It's not that the other governments weren't transparent. It's just the ability to go out and speak to the press. But my last question has to do with the municipal codes and rewriting them. What prompted you to go in that direction?
Oh, man. Our municipal code book was an enormous book stop, or door stop, you know? I mean, if I stubbed my toe on it, I would have probably broken my toe. And more importantly, there were things in there that we were supposed to enforce that we weren't enforcing. There were things in there that were violations that were so clearly written that you couldn't enforce them. You know, they were contradictory. Melody, it was actually fixed by two city council people about a year before I became mayor. But, you know, I wanted to become mayor. I was going to run for mayor, so I thought, hey, I ought to know what a mayor does. So I grabbed a code book from the city and looked up what the mayor is supposed to do. And it happened that a councilman from Ward 2 and a council lady from Ward 1 had looked at this and found it, but they hadn't amended the code book yet, at least the one I was given. On one page it says the mayor must vote on all issues. And I go, whoa, that's different than I thought. Well, that's interesting. So I keep reading, and the next page it says, the mayor only votes in the setting of a tie. So up until about 4 years ago, that was in our code book.
Okay.
Come on, right? And so those things have to be fixed. The other thing that has to be fixed, for example, is we still have, this is really tiny stuff, Vicki. This is not what you guys want to talk about, but we still have a dog owner in the city of Salida has to have a dog license. Well, there's about 75 or 100 dog licenses. And I don't know if you remember the article in the Denver Post saying they ought to change the name of Salida to Saliva because of the number of dogs in town. And so why have a code, something in your code book, that makes everybody a criminal? You know, if we're not enforcing it, get rid of it. Now, what I would do is I would offer it as a service. I'd say, come in and pay $10 one time, and we will know which dog tag goes to which dog. And that's a convenience to the cops. When a dog's running, they pick up the dog, they know who to call. I can see that as a service, but let's not make it a violation. We have something in our code book that says if your neighbor will not cut their weeds and you ask them to and they still won't cut their weeds, Public Works will come and cut the weeds and there'll be a violation written. Do you want our Public Works guys to be cutting weeds in someone else's yard? And it's just eliminate the stuff that we can't enforce and only put the stuff in there that is really the core things government ought to do. And, Melody, we were committed to having this done by November. Boy, we're doing the biggest chunks first. I don't know if it's going to happen, but we have finished the building deal. We're working on land use. Those are the two biggest ones. I don't know if we're going to get it done, but we're trying.
Well, and as far as, you know, what do you plan on doing when you're, you know, when are you going to be out of office then? Is it the end of the year?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. It's, you know, the election, I think, is, let me just, I'd have to look. It's the first, I believe it should be on the 8th. My memory is it's the first Tuesday, it's the Tuesday of the first whole week. So I think it's on the 8th. Oh, I'm looking at, yeah, November. They take... A new mayor takes office very quickly, I think within two weeks. So I think I'm done by the end of November.
Okay, and so what do you have on your mind to do from there?
I'm not going to do anything publicly for at least 6 months. I think one thing that I think George Bush did was a wonderful example of, and Dick Cheney was not, is you don't start stepping on the toes of your predecessor. At least let them learn where the bathroom is, you know? And that doesn't mean I won't be checking the news and I won't be talking to my friends on the council and I won't be talking to my other friends who are politically aware. But I'm not going to do anything. And so there's a few things I have in mind.
Okay, but what about your radio programs?
No, I think that's something... Firstly, I would not have the information, not being an elected official, necessary to really do that well.
Mm-hmm.
Only people from Salida would get a kick out of this, but I've talked to a few people about doing a radio show called Merle Watch, just because some of the stuff, his opinion pieces, you know, I don't mind when people disagree with me, but I wish they were based in fact. And unfortunately, a lot of Merle stuff, in my opinion, isn't. But I don't want to do that. You know, Mill Baranchak's a good guy. We just disagree on a lot of stuff. Although, anyway, the factual stuff, he operates from a different set of facts than I do, apparently. But I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try and continue my record. I'm the only guy in my family that hasn't had a heart attack in his 50s. So maybe I can make it through my 60s. That'll be my goal. We'll see.
I think it would be great if you jumped onto the alternate media and joined us in what we do, because anybody who can explain things in a coherent way is needed in the alternate media, because there's a lot of disinformation, as you say, a lot of conspiracy theory, and a lot of very confused people.
Well, you know, the real problem, Vicki, is we are in the information age, but no one's ever accused it of being the quality of information age. And, you know, our intelligence services took a lot of heat for 9/11, and they should have. They made some serious mistakes. But imagine the quantity of information that pours across their desk daily. How the heck do you know?
Well, that's true.
Well, Chuck, I want to thank you for spending the time with us, and because I know you're a busy person, and I really do appreciate you explaining your position. And again, it's like, you know, I know that we didn't necessarily get in the directions that we appeared to be going, but, you know, unless we get a basis and get a feel for where you're coming from and what you're exposed to, then, you know, then we can't start formulate it from our opinions from the direction that we feel is best suits the people that we try to inform. Any closing comments, Vicki?
No, but I enjoyed it, and I did learn some things, so, and that's the point of the whole thing. So I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.